Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How confident are you that your children have a bright future ahead of them? In a recent poll, nearly two-thirds of U.S. adults were unsure whether their children's lives would be as good as their own. From terrorism to environmental worries to a shrinking middle class, my guest today sees signs that the country is in serious trouble, but he also believes that by acknowledging our problems and seeking solutions not tied to party politics, we can find our way back to a positive outlook. David Boren has served as both governor and senator for the state of Oklahoma and had the longest term in history as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Today, he is president of the University of Oklahoma, and he's in North Texas to talk about his newly published book, A Letter to America. Senator Boren, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
You write, we have confused leadership with dominance. Can you explain that?
Well, I think that, you know, in the past, we've beaten our chests and said, we're the world's only superpower. And the world is changing. We're only 6% of the population of the world. You look at India and China, their economies have been growing so fast that people tell us that within 25 years, they'll equal our own. That means they could be, if they wanted to be, our military equals as well, and they have 10 times as many people. So you have to, I think, look at leadership in a different way. It's not dominance. It's the kind of moral influence. It's the kind of leadership you can have in the world. Harold Macmillan, who's one of my heroes, was the Prime Minister of Great Britain. And, of course, he's sort of been overshadowed by Churchill, understandably. But he gave a very wise speech about 1960, and he was in essence educating the British people about the end of the British Empire. And he said, you know, we're not going to have the British Empire anymore, but we can still be world leaders because we have kept our relationship with those countries that have been our colonies in the past. We have passed on values. We have passed on political institutions. And we've also learned diplomacy. We realize that in the tool chest, it's not just military might, but also our ability to move diplomatically, to think, to listen, to form partnerships with other people. And, you know, we're moving in a world that's moving in that direction. We're not going to be the single superpower. Let's hope we're going to be a leading power in the world. I think for the sake of the world, it's good for us to be a leading power in the world or the leading power in the world. We're going to have to form partnerships. We're going to have to learn how to listen. We're going to have to share ideas. We're going to have to inspire by our values. We're going to have to lead through diplomacy as well as the threat of military strength, which should be a last resort. So it's a very different world, and that's one of the reasons why it concerns me when I read the polling data that after 9/11, for example, and for many years indeed, the world approved of the United States. They appreciated the United States. They remembered things like the Marshall Plan when we rebuilt Europe after World War II in a very unselfish way. The British, for example, after 9/11, the public approved of us 92%. It's fallen to 22%. In many parts of the world, it's in single digits. Well, why has that happened? So I decided to look at some more polling data. I became fascinated with it. Why have they changed their attitude toward the United States so much? And again, in Western Europe, countries friendly to the United States, even Canada, over 80% of the people said, you know, Americans don't really listen to us. They don't really care about us. They don't really care about our interests. Well, if we're going to lead in a new way, if we're going to lead through partnership, we have to become listeners as well as talkers.
So how do we manage those times when we, assuming that we do listen with an open mind to the opinions of the rest of the world, and we still feel that we have to take an alternate course of action, how do we manage those times when we do go it alone?
Well, I think we have to, again, do a lot of explain to people why we have to go alone so that we're not just out there without showing respect for their opinion. We have to show respect. But then we always do have to be strong enough. I've always said, and I've been a strong supporter of national defense, the United States should always be strong enough to act all by ourselves to protect our national interest if we have to. But we ought to be wise enough that we rarely have to do so. And, you know, Chris, one example I think is very educational if we look at it. The first Gulf War versus the second Gulf War in Iraq. During the first Gulf War, President Bush Sr. and General Scowcroft, one of his leading advisors, and others, Secretary of State Baker from Texas, they thought about this a long time. One of the things they did is they built a real coalition. It wasn't just a cosmetic coalition where, 18 or 20 countries sent 200 troops each. It was a real coalition, almost 100 countries. And the countries that didn't send troops, like the Japanese, for example, forbidden by their constitution to send military troops elsewhere, they made financial contributions. And, for example, this war is now approaching $1 trillion in costs, this Iraq war, to the American taxpayers. Do you know how much the first war in the Persian Gulf cost the American taxpayers? Zero. In fact, we don't make a big point of it. We were slightly over-reimbursed by a few million dollars. And the casualties, of course, were much lower. And not only that, the first President Bush was sensitive enough that the very first units that saw action in combat were not from Western countries. They were from Islamic countries, the very first units that saw combat in the first Gulf War, so that the war was not portrayed as a war between the West against all of Islam, for example. So, there are ways of doing things that can enable us to form partnerships, not overstretch ourselves, not put all of the burden on the American taxpayers, not put all of the threat of loss of life onto young Americans, and to also reduce the chance of loss of life of civilians in the other countries. So I think we need to learn a lot from history, and we need to take the time to educate ourselves.
To the extent that parts of the world are certainly much more stable today than they were 60 years ago, does the world need a U.S. superpower?
Yes, I think the United States is still needed, because I think you create a power vacuum in the world if you don't have American leadership. And that's when I talk about a new style of leadership. It doesn't mean that we should go away from the world. In fact, we really can't withdraw from the world. And that's why we have to be concerned about the attitudes of people in other parts of the world, even if we think they're unfair. And I'm sort of like the typical American. I get angry when I read these polls. I think to myself, why don't they appreciate us? Don't they know all we've done for them over the years? And I think that's true. But we have to be concerned. We learned, for example, after World War I, we withdrew from the world. And we created a power vacuum in the world. And what happened? World War II came along. We had the rise of Hitler. He wasn't stopped early enough. Had we not played our role in the Cold War, for example, it would have come out very differently. And we were able to stay together, build alliances that worked with us, and we were able to win the Cold War. And another reason, Chris, why we were able to win the Cold War is that we set aside partisanship when it came down to really building strategies that would last over the long term, that would carry us through four decades, whether the Republicans were in the White House or Democrats, or it didn't matter who controlled Congress. We stuck with the same basic strategic plan that we had hammered out in a bipartisan way. All started with the Marshall Plan, for example, when Truman and Marshall said, the communists are going to take over Western Europe if we don't do something. These people are hungry. They're desperate. They're ready to be taken over by an idea like communism. We have to step in. So it means taxing the American people to rebuild countries like Germany.
And those were high taxes at the time.
They were high taxes. And just think about it. We were asking the American people to pay taxes to support the very countries that had killed our sons and daughters in war, that had caused us to have to sacrifice at home and to tax ourselves at home. Now, if we'd had the kind of partisan politics that we have today, can you imagine the 32nd attack spots that you could have put together against the Marshall Plan? They're out to tax you to help our enemies. Instead, you had Senator Arthur Vandenberg. I'm a Democrat. He happens to be a Republican. He was a Republican. He's one of my heroes because he understood that the national interest had to come first. And so he said, we're not going to make this partisan, Mr. President. We're going to join together Republicans and Democrats and pass the Marshall Plan. Now, we need to be doing things like that again. We have to have that kind of cooperation, because when you look at where the United States is right now, the attitude toward us around the world, the attitude toward ourselves, when two-thirds of us as Americans, and this has never happened before in our history, are pessimistic about our future. They think that our future will not be as great as our past. Historians and sociologists tell us that if you want to really test the strength of a country, look at how they feel about their own future. So we have to be concerned about that. We have to change those numbers. We have to take action. And that means we have to do it together, united. And there have to be times in which we set aside our differences as Democrats and Republicans to do that.
You supported Michael Bloomberg's thought that he might run for president.
Yes.
And you said for a while that you would definitely ask him to run for president if there were not another major candidate that you felt could unite the two parties. He's decided not to run.
Yes.
What do you think? Is there someone left in the three candidates we have that can fill that void?
Well, I think there possibly are. I think that we have to hear some more from the candidates. I think what he really decided, and it's a very practical thing, I'm not really a person who likes a three-party system. I think the two-party system has served us very well. But I was beginning to think that maybe we needed a timeout from the two-party system, that we needed some shock therapy to the two-party system, that we needed to do something to get them to cooperate in the way that they historically have cooperated when it's been needed in our country. And I think what Mayor Bloomberg was looking at is how much room is there left in the center? The more polar the candidates were moving to the right and to the left, and I wrote this book back in July, so it was not clear how things were going to evolve, there might have been room for someone to come in the middle. I think he reached the decision that it looked like Senator Obama might be nominated, for example. It looked like Senator McCain, and now he has been, in essence, assured of the Republican nomination. He had been more moderate than some of the other Republican candidates. His worry now is trying to get the conservative base. So I think he felt that if those were the two likely nominees, there was less room in the center. I think had there been more polarizing likely nominees, then there would have been enough room in the center that someone like Mayor Bloomberg could actually have won. You know, people always say, could it ever really happen that an independent could be elected president of the United States? Yes, I think this was a year in which it might have happened had it come out differently. My hope is, my firm hope is, because I prefer this to the three-party system, is that the nominees will take heart, that they'll create some new institutions, that they'll announce, for example, we're not creating a Republican cabinet or a Democratic cabinet. We're going to have an American cabinet, like Churchill put together during the war in England. We're going to pick the best people without regard to party, not just some tokenism, one Republican or one Democrat on the cabinet, but a united cabinet. We're going to create some bipartisan working groups, little groups headed by the president, key cabinet members, leading members of the Democratic and Republican Party on the critical three or four committees in the House and Senate and work together in a new way. So, yes, you know, one of the things that encourages me, I'm encouraged when I hear Senator Obama, for example, say at Democratic rallies, now this is really unusual, welcome Republicans, welcome independents, we're glad you're here at this meeting.
You think that's more than just campaign rhetoric?
I think it's more than campaign rhetoric, having listened to him. I hope that he will now take up some of the ideas. And by the way, I know he's read the book because he called me about reading the book. And I hope he'll take up some of these ideas because you have to do things that create new institutions that cause bipartisanship. It used to happen just naturally. When I went to the Senate, there were 8 Democrats elected that year and 8 new Republicans elected that year. Believe it or not, we became friends. We had potluck dinners once a month at each other's houses with our spouses. We brought dishes, sort of like old-fashioned small-town living, and we became friends. And that helped us really work together when the times called for it. They don't do that anymore. And so you have to artificially create situations like these working groups I talked about, where you get the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the Director of the CIA, and the President sitting at the table with the chairs and ranking members of, say, Intelligence, Armed Services, and Foreign Relations, and make it happen. So I'm hoping we'll hear from him. I'm hoping we'll hear from John McCain, who I hope returns to some of his earlier positions. I co-sponsored the first campaign finance reform bill with him years ago, which hasn't been mentioned too much lately.
Former U.S. Senator and Oklahoma Governor David Boren is my guest. He's in town for a book signing this evening. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Senator and former Oklahoma Governor David Boren. He is now President of the University of Oklahoma. His new book is called A Letter to America, and he will be at an event at 5:30 this evening at the Hilton Lincoln Center on LBJ Freeway in Dallas. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think at KERA.org. Senator, you write that America's students come to the college classroom worse prepared than either their foreign peers or their parents or grandparents. In what ways?
Well, I think that, first of all, they're not as broadly read, which I think is part of the ways in which they're less prepared. They're certainly less prepared in the area of knowing their own history and knowing the history of the world. That means that you look at current events, they don't understand current events because they can't put them in perspective. They don't know the history. It's just shocking. It's a real crisis of citizenship for us as a people. If you don't know how you've become great as a nation, how are you going to stay great? And I'm sure you've seen some of this data recently that half the high school graduates in this country last year thought we fought on the side of Germany and the Nazis during World War II. And what was even more alarming is that they took a study was made of just the Ivy League college graduates. By the way, the seniors in the Ivy League knew less than the freshmen about American history. 30% of them couldn't name George Washington as our commander-in-chief in the Revolutionary War. And I guess what worried me even more, one-fourth of them, these are Ivy League students, thought that the President of the United States had the right to suspend the American Constitution, the Bill of Rights, our freedom of press, freedom of speech, free exercise of religion, at his or her own discretion. Now, you know, if we don't know more about our own history, if we don't know more about our own system of government, how in the world, as citizens, are we going to preserve our freedoms, and how in the world are we going to rebuild the strength of the country? We've always been problem solvers. We've met every challenge, whether it was Pearl Harbor, whether it was the Great Depression, and we came through it without changing our political system. And we must get back to understanding how we did that if we're going to be able to do it again. And I think we're facing a situation, it's not as dramatic as a Pearl Harbor, but it's a slow erosion, in fact, a rapidly increasing erosion of our strength around the world. When you look at what's happening to our dollar, when you look at what's happening to us economically, when you look at how stretched our military is, stretched so thin and stressed around the world, we really face some very serious challenges. And then when you see that here at home, the real source of strength, the glue that's held this country together, the middle class, is shrinking in size at rates that just are frightening. And so our students desperately need to come to all of these modern day challenges with some knowledge of what we've done in the past.
Is there an inherent flaw in our culture, which has always prided itself on innovation and on looking toward the future? Does that automatically come with a risk that we won't give sufficient interest to our history?
Well, maybe so. I don't know. I think that we've been creative people all along, and yet we have seemed to know more about our history, and we've studied more broadly history and literature and put things into perspective. And I think that also we're being overwhelmed by the amount of information. And that's something that, you know, Daniel Boorstin, the great historian, spoke what he called Boorstin's Law. The more information we have, the less knowledge we have. And he was certainly not all wrong. I think about the time that I served as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. During that 6 years, just the raw amount of data, because we improved our technology so. We could look down from our spy satellites and read the front page of Pravda if someone was walking down the street in Moscow and tell what was there. Naturally, we listened into conversations all over the world. We could see through photographs what was going on. The raw data that came down on the CIA headquarters probably increased 25 or 50 times in that 6 years. And yet some human being had to write down into about 6 pages for the president's brief every morning what was really important and what really demanded the president's attention and what was long range importance as well. So the amount of sheer information has to some degree overwhelmed, I think, the human capacity to make sense of what's really important. That's the difference between knowledge and wisdom and just sheer information.
Well, and it seems particularly for young people that would be a risk because, you know, after having several decades of adulthood under your belt, you can decide for yourself what's worth it. How do you guide students to know how to choose what's worth their time and what's not?
Well, I go back to, again, perspective. And that's one of the reasons why I think while technology is extremely important, science is extremely important, we can't leave out this knowledge of history. And it's just shocking. Students don't learn what is not taught. And only 8% of the colleges and universities in this country, I'm happy to say OU is among the 8%, require a single course in American history or American government in order to receive a degree. Only 8%. And only about 15% of the colleges and universities, they follow what's called a cafeteria plan in the core curriculum, require a single course of history of any kind in order to graduate. So I think, you know, that's part of it. We have to sit back and we have to look at the basics, including our history, look at the basics in terms of philosophy, where the ideas came from that are framing what's going on in our world. And if we don't do that, we will be overwhelmed by the information. So I think we have to step back as educators. There are certain parts of the core curriculum that ought to be there, and students still ought to take history. They ought to take English, and they ought to learn about literature and characters from literature because it teaches about human life, and they need to study some basic philosophy and ethics. Then they can make sense of what's going on in the world around them and all this information that's coming at them. So we need to really step up, I think, as educators and meet that challenge.
My guest is the president of the University of Oklahoma and former governor of the state and senator, David Boren. His book is called A Letter to America, and he'll appear at a book signing event this evening at 5:30 at the Hilton Lincoln Center in Dallas. Our number to join the conversation is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak to Adrian in Rockwall. Hi, Adrian.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I don't dispute any of the things that your guests are saying, but for me, I have a hard time having respect for people like him because he had the chance to bring the truth out when he was elected. Everyone after retires decides to tell the truth. I mean, come on. You had the chance to make a difference. And you choose not to. Why? Because the American people don't like to hear the truth. And you knew that if you tell the truth, you're not going to get elected, or you have a slim chance of getting elected. So for me, I'm sorry, it bothers me very much that these people come out after they were senators or congressmen or governors. So I'm sorry.
Well, let's get a response for you. Thanks for your call, Adrian.
Well, I don't know, Adrian, if you know how long I've been out of office, but it's now going on 14 years that I'm president of the University of Oklahoma. And while I was in office, let me tell you what I did do. I preached bipartisanship just a moment ago. I said what needs to be done by the next president. Well, during the time that I chaired the Senate Intelligence Committee, 6 years, we did not have a single party line vote in an entire 6 years. And I don't think that's ever happened in any other committee. We sat there until we reached consensus, and only 3 times did we even have to have a vote, and they weren't even close and they weren't along party lines. So we worked together. We worked together, for example, on arms control negotiations. As a Democrat, I went over to the White House, sat down with President Reagan and General Powell, who were there at that time, and we actually worked on letters that I would send as chairman of the Intelligence Committee, that Senator Nunn, who was also a Democrat, chaired the Armed Forces Committee, that we would send over to the president because he wanted to have those letters to take to the Russians and say, see if these verification procedures are not in here, the Senate won't ratify the treaty. So we worked very, very closely together. And I also joined in many, many bipartisan proposals to do something about the budget deficit and the entitlement programs that still have not been reformed. Here we are. In 20 years, according to the Concord Coalition of Experts, bipartisan, it will take all of the taxpayers' dollars that come in the form of that come to pay entitlements, which are called Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, interest on the national debt. Nothing will be left for anything else. So if we don't start to act, and we tried to act then, and we had a bipartisan proposal, and I'm sorry to tell you, it didn't pass. But it wasn't for lack of trying. And so I would urge you, don't paint all. And I'm not saying I made every decision correctly. there's some things I'd like to go back and vote on again. There's some votes I'd like to take back. But don't paint every politician with the same brush. If you do, you're never going to get good people to get into politics. Watch for people that you think really are going to bring about the changes that need to be made in this country. Get out and help them and encourage them. And just don't sit out there and say that anyone that wants to go into politics and make a difference is evil. That's not true. I knew people that all they did look at was at the polls. All they really did care about was getting reelected. But I knew some people that really thought differently about that. And that's what I call old-fashioned statesmanship, and that's what I think we have to bring back. So I urge you to rethink that a little bit, not paint with a broad brush.
Senator, there are some people in office still today who are exceptionally powerful members of their own parties, who were there when you were there during a time that you felt things were much more bipartisan in spirit.
Yes.
What has changed? How have these individual players decided that this was the way they were going to run their lives in Washington and therefore their constituencies?
Well, I think a lot of things have changed. First, they're not as many. Frankly, a lot of the people that were part of this bipartisan team left. I think I mentioned Senator Nunn of Georgia a while ago. He was one of those. I happened to be a Democrat. Senator Danforth of Missouri, who happened to be a Republican, was one of those people. Howard Baker of Tennessee, who in fact was the Republican leader, was one of these people who pushed bipartisanship. There used to be 20 or 30 members of the Senate that I would call centrists, who really worked at bringing people together. That number is now down to probably 4 or 5 or maybe 6. So that's discouraging. That needs to change. But I think one of the other things that's been at work here is money. Money in politics. People don't realize it, but over half the members elected to Congress received over half their campaign contributions from people that don't even live in their home states, that probably never set foot in their home districts, from the special interest groups, the political action committees and others that are headquartered in Washington.
You say these folks are living off their campaign contributions.
Well, no, I'm just saying they have to raise so much money. The cost of winning, 98% of the time, the candidate that has the most money wins the election. And so what happens? These groups, they don't look at your broad record. How do you think Senator Boren serving is in the Senate? I approve of some things, disapprove of others. But they look only at the narrow issues. You know, if it's the banking association, how did he vote on these 3 votes that affected our interests? If it's a labor union, how did he vote on those 3 votes that affected our interests? So whatever it happens to be. And I looked at the cost. This is just unbelievable. For an average U.S. senator, they have to raise about $50,000 in campaign contributions every single week for 6 years in order to raise the average amount to be elected. Just since the Carter-Ford race, and people say, oh, well, there's always been money in politics. Not like it is today. Just since the Carter-Ford race, the amount of money being spent on presidential elections and congressional campaigns has gone up 30 times. 30 times. So what's happening is I think this is really splintering the body politic, and they realize they have to raise the money in order to win, and the special interest groups are really beginning to splinter what otherwise might be a national consensus. So I think that's a big part of what's changed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jeff in Fort Worth. Hi, Jeff.
Hey. Thank you, Senator Boren, for stepping back in the arena. And I can tell the previous caller, Adrian, firsthand, you were speaking about this when you were in the Senate and were so eloquent and effective. We had you as our lead speaker in 1995 at a UWSA conference.
Right.
In Dallas. And so that is just a misnomer. But anyway, I want to ask a question about a rather dry issue to many, but a immense issue, and that is redistricting.
Right.
And going beyond people who get elected to office into the dialogue that takes place after they are in office because of the districts they are in, be it the far right wing or far left wing. Senator Bradley, in his recent book, proposed public financing along with, I believe, redistricting commissions. But how do we get from point A to point B on the commissions?
Well, I think that you're really right. You know, this is something, it is a sort of technical subject, but it is really important because what's happened over the years is the Democrats and Republicans and whoever happened to control, say, the state legislature at that time has drawn districts that tried to maximize the number of seats for their own party. Let's say if the Republicans were in the majority, they wanted the most seats for in members in Congress that would be Republican. So they've tended to put, say, all the Democrats then into as few districts as possible. And the Democrats have done the same thing wherever they've been in control. They're equally at fault, both the two parties. So what you do is you get a district that is totally a safe Democratic district. And whoever holds that district doesn't really have to meet the other party halfway. They don't have to be more moderate in their point of view. They don't have to control they don't have to gain the votes of the independents and the centrists and those that would moderate the more extreme positions. So by creating districts that are safe Republican or all safe very, very far to the right or very, very safe all the way to the left, you create the very Congress I talked about, where instead of having 20, 30, 40 centrists in the U.S. Senate, you have only four or five or six. So I do think that a part of solving the problem that we've been talking about is setting up some sort of impartial redistricting commission, perhaps under the courts. And this is just going to take a lot of public pressure, I think, to bring this issue to the legislature. To say to the legislature, don't do the redistricting yourselves. Let's get an impartial bipartisan commission to do it. And let's have the goal of doing it fairly, putting people together who belong together in terms of geography. My goodness, some of the congressional districts, if you look at it, they're so weird looking. They make a little narrow space 10 miles wide to connect two totally different parts of a state, for example, just so they can get all the Democrats or all the Republicans in the same district. That's wrong. And I think also all the states ought to allow the independents, people registered as independents, to vote in either primary. That also moderates the electorate, because right now, if to get nominated by a party, all you need to do is appeal to the extremists in your party, we're going to get more polarized than ever.
Former Oklahoma Governor and U.S. Senator David Boren is my guest. He is currently president of the University of Oklahoma, and he's the author of a book called A Letter to America. We'll resume our conversation after the break. You can get on the line to join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. This hour, my guest is former Senator and Oklahoma Governor David Boren. He is currently the president of the University of Oklahoma. He is in town to speak and to sign copies of his book, A Letter to America, this evening at 5:30 at the Hilton Lincoln Center in Dallas. To join our conversation today, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Lynn in Grapevine writes, she's curious as to whether you advocate voting against incumbents in order to foster the kind of cooperation in Congress that you've proposed. Would new members be more inclined to work together than the old guard?
Well, I think in some ways they would. Now, again, you have to judge every person as an individual, as I said to our first caller. You should paint them all together, because there are people that are earnestly trying to make these changes. But one of the real problems, and this goes back to campaign finance reform, guess who has the advantage when it comes to raising money? And this is it's the incumbent. If you're sitting there and you have a vote on raising or lowering the taxes for a certain, let's say, economic group or business group, are you going to give money to the challenger with that person sitting there, already there, ready to vote? No. What we found out is that with a ratio of about 6-1, whether it's a Democrat, a Republican, a liberal, conservative, the person in office has a huge advantage on raising money over a challenger. And so it makes it harder and harder for new people to break in with new and creative ideas. So I do think that it's very important for us to level the playing field, and it's very important I think, for us to keep it open for new people to come in with new ideas. Idealism is still very strong and hasn't yet been blunted. And I think also we desperately need the right leadership from the president on down on this whole issue of acting in a bipartisan fashion, for example. The president sets the tone. The people once said, dance to the tune the leader plays. And I think we desperately need leadership that will not be partisan, that will put the country first. As I said, we need a president who will be an American first and make it very clear that that's exactly what he or she is going to be. So that's important. We need new people. We need to give new people a chance by changing our campaign finance laws. And we need someone who will set the tone in a different way.
Do you think term limits are appropriate?
I don't think term limits are necessarily appropriate, although I finally decided to limit myself because I do think that it's healthy to bring in new people with new approaches. It was very interesting. I was serving on the Board of Trustees for a while of Yale University, and I went from one of my trustees meetings. It was so interesting. We were talking about a problem, and in that room was a research scientist. In that room was the CEO of a major business corporation. In that room was Bud Trillin, the great author, who is also something of a always sees the humor in life. And there were people there of great ethnic diversity, great professional diversity. And as we talked about what to do, I was struck by how rich the conversation was, how many perspectives there were. I went back 2 days later, and I was sitting in the back room of the Senate Finance Committee, and there were all these senators there talking about a very important issue. And I looked around the room, and I realized that it had been 10 or 15 years since anyone in that room had done anything other than be a politician. One was once head of an insurance company, but it had been a long time ago. One had once been a farmer, but it had been so far ago that he'd probably forgotten how to plant a crop. So there wasn't this kind of rich diversity representing the whole talent base of the American people. So I do think that there should be turnover. I think turnover is very healthy. I thought it was very healthy for myself to turn myself over.
And 2 years early, is that right?
I left the Senate 2 years early to become president of the University of Oklahoma, and I'm so glad because I dedicate this book, for example, to my students because they have the honesty to ask the questions that ought to be asked. They cause me to change my way of thinking about a lot of issues. So I think it's very good to keep people coming into the Congress, for example, who are fresh from trying to make a small business work, fresh from the classroom, listening to the aspirations of young people, or whatever it might happen to be. I think that's healthy. I wish we could do it more with campaign finance reform and giving challengers a greater chance than with term limits because we need a balance. You also once in a while need those wise old heads who've seen this same kind of crisis before and realized how we solved it. And so you need a balance. It's sort of like the generations. You know, I think it's too bad that in our country we've become so mobile. It's part of the strength of our economy, but people have to move around in corporations and so on. But fewer and fewer are able to live where their grandparents are very close by, all the generations of a family gathered together. And you not only are listening to people your own age, you're listening to those wonderful stories. There's a lot of truth in the story and a lot of truth in what went on in this town 50, 100 years ago that comes when you have the generations living together. And so we miss some of that. It's one of the reasons why at the University of Oklahoma we now have a faculty family that lives in every single residence hall. And they're not there to be disciplinarians. They're there to be intergenerational friends. And we have bull sessions with them and faculty members with the students on a regular basis because it kind of substitutes for that extended family. So few of our students have been able to grow up around their grandparents and around older people in the community that could give them that kind of intergenerational friendship. So we've lost some of that in our country, and I think we need both, but I think term limits might be a bit of a sledgehammer that causes us to get rid of some of the wise old heads that we need. But the way we finance campaigns today and the way we're drawing these districts, as has been referred to, that's keeping a lot of talented new people out that ought to have an opportunity to be there.
My guest is former Oklahoma Senator and Governor David Boren. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Carrie in Southlake. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Senator, you must practice what you preach because I've met your son, and he must have listened to quite a few of those stories. He's a very impressive young man.
Thank you.
I have a question that would require you to wear a number of your hats. I have a son who is in high school at this point and is subject to public schools' idea of what it takes to build a student.
Right.
From what your perspective seems to say, he might not be getting the breadth of knowledge necessary to make the decisions that the society requires of him. As a college president and a person of your international perspective, what would you suggest we do to help him move forward in this world, to give him that breadth of knowledge that he's going to need?
Well, I think that, one, we should continue as parents to work on the curriculum of the local schools. And that is, we've dropped a lot of things that used to be there that we need to get back. In some ways, we need to sort of go back to the future, so to speak. Geography was something I learned as a student. I'm so glad I did, because what it really was international relations. We learned about other countries. We learned about their demographics, their history. We learned it all through what was called geography at the time. And your son and your children, just like my children and grandchildren, are going to live in a world where it's very important for us to interact internationally. As I said before, it's not just going to be automatic with only 6% of the population of the world that everyone else is going to bow down and just say, oh, we'll do whatever the United States wants, or we'll buy the United States products and services. No, we have to have an understanding of the rest of the world in order to succeed. So I think that's important. I think when your child goes off to college, make sure also that he or she studies abroad. I think that's very important. It's one of the things that I've emphasized. We have more exchange agreements at OU with universities around the world, over 170 interchangeable credits, than any other public or private university in the country. And I think that's so important. Here we sit in the middle of the country, North Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and so on. We need to really break out of that, and we have to really work at bringing that diversity. We have students from over 100 countries, and many of our students volunteer to be cousins. We have over 2,000 who volunteer to be cousins for our international students, do things together once a week or once every other week. This is a very important part. This is a very important part, I think, of the learning process.
One of the concerns about programs that put U.S. students in other places is that their parents want them in relatively safe environments. Their parents want them in,
yes,
you know, Western Europe.
Yes.
And the countries we really don't understand well are in other places. And truthfully, their universities are not necessarily the envy of the world in these places that we actually need to learn more about.
No, I think that, you know, when it comes to higher education in terms of just learning the subject matter, learning math, for example, we do a better job in the United States than any place. It's why everyone's beating down the door to get into our colleges and universities. And we, by the way, we need to keep those doors open and not throw up roadblocks, as I'm afraid the current administration has through various visa requirements, because those students go home and they become the best friends the United States ever had in their home countries, because they understand us, unlike a lot of people around them. I think, though, that having at least relatively brief experiences in educational settings in other countries is very important. Right now, 90% of our students who study are going to Italy, Germany, France, Britain, and Spain. Very few are going to what we would call countries in the third world. Very few are going to Asia, which is going to loom so large in our future. It's the economic powerhouse. How we get along with those emerging Asian nations is going to determine whether or not we have a safe world or not. So we need to send students to China to study, to India to study. We need to send them to some of the former republics of what was the Soviet Union. We need to send them to Africa. So we constantly are looking for areas which we think would be the safest areas, but still give an understanding. For example, we're in the process now of establishing an exchange program that would allow our students to go. They'd be supervised by some of our own staff in the summer to Turkey, for example, so that they would be in a country that's an Islamic country, and yet they would be in a place that is safe and secure, but still have an opportunity to get a bird's eye view into another culture. And, you know, you learn not only about that other culture, you learn about the United States, because when you start to see our own country through the eyes of people in another country, it makes all the difference in the world. And I think you start to have a better understanding. One of the things that I propose in my book is we need to start thinking out of the box. How do we rebuild our relationship with the rest of the world? Well, one of the ways I think might work is the creation of an international peace corps. Why not get young people, when they're so open to each other and friendships, to come together from different countries and work on projects that will help all the nations of the world, and especially those that need it most? And those young people from various countries who will have worked together as a team are going to become the future leaders of their own countries in years ahead. So I think that establishing an international peace corps or something would be wonderful for the next president to do. And I think it would build a friendship and an ability to have partnership that would continue what I called the right kind of American leadership. That's a leadership that listens and shares and partners, and not just the sort of dominant idea of leadership.
Let's go to a final call. We can speak to Chris in Garland. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I tuned in when you were talking about ignorance among our students and our lack of knowledge, basic knowledge. And I agree. I actually agree with that quite a bit. I taught in a third world country, and people were much more curious. But on the issue of the divided government, I don't think it's been this divided ever since, I don't know, Newt Gingrich or somebody. And I don't know what to do about it. You get people like Karl Rove and people like that, and I'm sure you got them on the left as well, working very hard to divide the people. And we're a house divided against ourselves, and it's very, very partisan. And it seems like it's impossible to break that that hold. And one other quick thing on campaign finance: the people who are running the government are voting for the laws that allow, like, free speech for corporations to give all kinds of money to people. They're their own worst enemies. They're the worst enemies of this country, in the sense that they're the ones who do not propose legislation that makes campaign finance affordable for ordinary people.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. We have time, Senator, probably just to address one of those things.
I'll be really quick. I think it's going to take a grassroots effort. It's going to take a lot of pressure on Congress, and it may take state legislatures pushing for constitutional amendments. I think that's true. The partisanship, for example, I think I mentioned that every week all the Democrats get in one room for 3 or 4 hours. It's called the Democratic Caucus. All the Republicans get in one room for 3 or 4 hours, the Republican Caucus. And all they talk about is how to score points against each other. That's why I emphasize we're going to have to create some new institutions. Since my old potluck dinner, all of us getting together as Democrats and Republicans, is not happening, that's the reason why I think we need to create what I call bipartisan mini cabinets, and that is, you know, if you sit in a room with a person long enough and you're going to have to see them every week and sit side by side, you're going to work together more closely. The president needs to create those kinds of working groups, the next president, and make it happen.
You can see former U.S. Senator David Boren today at the Hilton Lincoln Center at 5:30 p.m. He'll be signing books and also giving an address. The book is called A Letter to America. Senator, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.